The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This Saturday we have some American songs and some Canadian songs and some songs that are half Canadian, half American. But don't worry, plenty of folks from closer to home. Cilla Black, Ted Heath, Val Dunican, David Bowie. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. June 26th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where we are in the final week of the election campaign, 9 p.m. in Paris, where we are in the final days of the election campaign, 10 p.m. in Kyiv, where Zelensky has cancelled the election, so no final days or final week there, 10:30 p.m. in Tehran, for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone, midnight 45 in Kathmandu, for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone, 3 a.m. in Singapore and Hong Kong, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. I'm sorry for you Singaporeans and Sydney-siders. 7 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Thank you for all your condolences about Marvin, my beloved cat who died 8 days ago and left me in very rough shape for last week's show. I'm so touched, and all your messages got me through some rather miserable days. I'm going to try to be a bit cheerier this week, but it's not easy. North Korea has just announced that it will send troops to Ukraine to fight alongside Russia. So that's great news. The war is widening. In Germany, in Solingen, in the Rhineland today, 4 people are injured after an African immigrant attempted to blow up an Arab restaurant. He took what appeared to be an incendiary device from his trousers, spilled some of whatever cocktail was in it, and accidentally set himself alight. He is dead. 3 men are in hospital, as is a 7-year-old girl. Oh, one more. You'll love this one. And so it begins. Finland will become the first country to administer the new bird flu vaccine, starting next week. Okay, let's get to your questions. Aaron Everett writes, Mark, another win in the column for the rock-ribbed constitutionalists today. Overly exaggerated eye roll. This is in reference to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Murphy versus Mississippi case, brought in the wake of the collusion between the most powerful government on the continent and the social media cartel re-COVID, quote, misinformation. Murphy versus Mississippi. It's a bit of a setback for the First Amendment, it has to be said. And Aaron Everett says, how do people continue to fall for the notion that a president's only way to defend the Constitution is to appoint justices they know nothing about and who are put on some list by swamp insiders. It's not just that they know nothing about them. It's that whatever has hitherto been known may no longer be operative. They may grow in office, as the old line has it about Republicans who mysteriously become less Republican with the approval of the Washington Post and the New York Times. But Aaron continues, this has been the major argument for staying in the lines as a Republican for my entire voting life. Oh, yeah, it's about the Supreme Court. We got to vote for the Republican candidates. You said we've got to vote for him because then we'll get these rock-ribbed constitutional judges on the Supreme Court. So supposedly Trump gets these huge wins by the attrition of some old people on the court who didn't see their own death as imminent. He gets to choose some folks who no one really knows how they'll act when they get into the lights of court famousness, and we all fight like hell to defend them, only to have our veg and two bits. I think he's referring to the twig and berries there, but you're supposed to say meat and two veg. Only to have our veg and two bits, as Aaron puts it, kicked in by those very same people. The idea that the people in this case have no standing is hogswallop. That's like codswallop, but more porcine. That's like saying the government kills a guy, but because they're likely not to do it again to him, he has no standing. I'm over the whole thing. I'm making different decisions this election and leaving the plantation. What compels someone to stay in this one-sided, abusive relationship? Yeah, as I said, this is the Murphy versus Mississippi case over so-called government collusion with private entities, supposedly, although they're basically the social media cartel, social media monopolies, about COVID, quote, misinformation. It was brought by two state plaintiffs, Louisiana and Mississippi, and then five individuals, some of whom you'll know, such as Dr. J. Bhattacharya and Martin Koldorf, the two American authors of the Great Barrington Declaration on COVID. It would have been very sensible had the world followed the Great Barrington Declaration, but instead it was shut down by social media at the behest of the United States government, and the authors of it had their reputations destroyed. You've seen Jay on the Mark Stein Show talking sense, but the court today rejected the case on its now familiar grounds. Go on, take a wild guess that both the states and the individuals lacked standing. Because you have to have standing in order to be able to bring a suit. And increasingly, John Roberts Court, and John Roberts will go down, I think, increasingly as the Chief Justice who destroyed the entire rationale for the Supreme Court. John Roberts frequently uses a lack of standing to dispose of anything he doesn't want to go anywhere near, like 2020 election cases. But this time, in order to be able to do this, they had to torture the language somewhat, inflicting huge damage on something the Supreme Court had hitherto given great significance to and is particularly relevant in terms of my cases on either side of the Atlantic. And that is the so-called chilling effect of attempts to constrain speech and the self-censorship to which they lead. The chilling effect is a legal concept, was put into the language by the Supreme Court. Now they've basically gutted the chilling effect and the self-censorship that arises therefrom. As I think it was Sean Davis noted on Twitter, the Supreme Court's new position is that self-censorship is no more than someone choosing to inflict harm on himself based on what may be an entirely irrational fear of hypothetical harm that may or may not be imminent. So it's his own fault. So the chilling effect, so-called, has been gutted. As J. Bhattacharya wrote in a response, this means that the administration can censor ideas and no person will have standing to enforce the First Amendment. Free speech in America for the moment is dead, unquote. And as Sean Davis put it, the Supreme Court also appears to have created a brand new standard that appears nowhere in the First Amendment, coercion. The actual text in the Constitution sets the bar far lower, abridgment. If speech is abridged, the government has violated the Constitution. Now, he's right. But the Supreme Court has now added a new and necessary element of government, quote, coercion that you have to prove. And that's totally unknown to the Constitution. But what it does is it incentivizes. It basically gives John Roberts has just given a green light to the United States government and to Facebook and Google to do this all over again, which with whatever is next, the bird flu or the monkeypox or virus X or whatever it is they decide to impose upon you in the months before the election. Now, you're probably saying at this point, if you're one of these rock-ribbed constitution waivers, you're probably saying, well, wait a minute, don't we have a solid 6-3 rock-ribbed conservative majority on the Supreme Court? Well, Messrs. Alito, Thomas and Gorsuch stood firm for free speech. Roberts, Comey, Barrett and Kavanaugh all voted with the lefty troika. You think of how much energy the so-called conservative movement, which has failed to conserve anything, invested in getting Comey, Barrett and Kavanaugh. Do you remember Kavanaugh? Everyone thought they were all, oh, yes, okay, I like beer. You know, they did a number on him. They tried to do a number. Do you remember, what was her name? The late Dianne Feinstein doing her Yoda thing. The dogma is very strong with you, she told Amy. I wish the dogma was very strong with her. I wish it was with Kavanaugh too, but no. A hugely disturbing judicial decision. Do read Alito's dissent. He wrote an important dissent in my case in Washington. But this is bigger than some niche Canadian. It's bad news for a lot of reasons. As I always say, a line Tucker was very struck by when I first improvised it on Tucker Carlson Tonight at Fox News. As I always say, a judge's republic is a contradiction in terms. And those conservatives who have overinvested in it at the cost of abandoning all other societal levers have now been predictably rewarded. As Jonathan Turley said a couple of hours ago, the court has now given its imprimatur. This rock-ribbed 6-3 conservative court has now given its imprimatur to government censorship via powerful surrogates such as Facebook and Google. So you don't think they're going to do it again? I guess I can skip staying up late come Tuesday in November. Thank you very much for that question, Aaron. Very well put. Another on the, and you know, it never made any sense even before this, but it's certainly blown up in your face, all the Constitution. Like, I know what the Constitution is worth, and it's bugger all right now. The verdict in my trial in Washington, D.C. is totally unconstitutional because the court has ruled that you can't have an ratio between actual damages and punitive damages more than 9-1. In my case, it's 1,000,000-1. So the judge could very easily have said, oh, thank you very much, jury, because you've awarded Michael E. Mann $1 in actual damages and then $1,000,000 in punitive damages because you don't like the way that this Stein bloke was the guest host for Rush Limbaugh and Tucker Carlson. And that's true. I don't like him either. But unfortunately, that's totally unconstitutional. The maximum, if it's a buck struck in actual damages. The maximum you're allowed to levy in punitive damages is $9. So I'm going to have to reduce it to that. Instead, I got to spend years of my life that I don't have and millions of dollars to get that $1 million lowered to $9. So I'm constitutioned out. George Pazin, or Judge Pazin, he's actually George Pazin, but he quite enjoys the way I mistake him for a Quebecer and call him Judge Pazin. He says, "Hi, Mark. Bad news. I may stop mistaking him for a Quebecer and mistake him for someone from the Haute-Savoie, and he'd still be Georges Pazin. He says, "Hi, Mark. Bad news and not awful news on the free speech front. The Supreme Craps pulled another standing BS argument, choosing to allow the government to suppress speech through its emissaries. But at least Assange will be somewhat free, pleading guilty with time served, which is an affront to everyone. How do we get anyone to take free speech seriously when no one in any branch of government seems to? Did you ever consider showing up in clown face for any of your lawsuits? Apparently all aspects of all governments are now circus clown shows." This is a reference not only to today's Supreme Court decision, but to another one, which I found rather sad, but which I understand, is that basically after the High Court, same place I was at, the King's Bench Division of the High Court of England, where I was a few days after Mr. Assange, ruled that the United States government has not provided sufficient guarantees on the matter of whether, as a foreigner, because Mr. Assange is an Australian subject of the Crown and owes no allegiance to the US deep state, whether he would be allowed to, whether as a foreigner he would be allowed to plead the First Amendment. And the United States Department of Justice didn't even bother giving a serious answer to that. And somewhat to their surprise, the judges in the Assange case said, okay, then this is pretty serious. We're going to give him leave to appeal because you've... And at that point, the US DOJ thought that it was in danger of, losing this case. But the appeals would still have taken forever. And basically, Assange has been banged up for years and his health has completely deteriorated. He doesn't know his children. They only know him as a guy they visit in prison occasionally. And so he has heart problems, which, you know, I take seriously. Would you want to... The question is, to go back to George's point about free speech, do you want to die for an abstraction that increasingly millions of your fellow citizens have zero interest in? So because of his heart problems, he decided to do this deal where he would plead guilty to whatever it is he pleaded guilty for. But the hearing took place in some US island territory en route to Australia. So he wasn't on the US mainland. And it was an interesting question because he had to appear in person before the judge to agree to this settlement, which he did. And I forget what it, I don't know, what is it, in the Marshall Islands or whatever it is, I don't know what it is, Guam, I forget where it is. Anyway, there was always a question, once he was on US soil, whether they'd say, okay, the deal's off, and grab him and stick him in the Supermax and he'd never be heard from again, because American justice is corrupt. But he agreed to this, and he's now back in Australia. And I like the way Mike Pence is saying, oh, well, you know, here's the argument against it, that by leaking all this stuff, he jeopardized the lives of, you know, Afghans working for the American government. Well, as we saw after the fall of Kabul, nobody jeopardizes the lives of your local allies like the Pentagon and the United States government more generally. But the United States government, this is why I can't stand the bollocks. I can't stand the way The lack of journalistic curiosity, the lack of curiosity by hacks like Pence. But in fact, the United States court admitted, the United States government admitted in the English High Court that there were no such persons as, there were no such victims as people whose lives had been jeopardized by what Assange did. Doesn't exist. It's just bollocks. And I don't want any country, this case was a byproduct of the hideous deal that Blair and Bush did after 9/11. It was supposed to be, you know, for the war on terror. Remember that? The war on terror that America lost with the fall of Kabul. Because it's crap. And the Pentagon can't do anything. So no one should extradite to the United States. And people should keep, in case you run it afoul, you know, and I mean this for quite ordinary people, like for those January 6th people who've spent years in solitary confinement. They're just ordinary people with no criminal record. And, you know, in their late 60s, they decided to go up to Washington to attend a Trump rally. And their lives are over. And they've been in solitary confinement. A lot of them have been driven to suicide. Everybody, including Americans, should always keep a list on them of countries with no extradition treaties with this sick, diseased, depraved and corrupt justice system. You know, I think we had a question last week that I didn't really get to about regrets. You know, yes, being in litigation this long has destroyed my health. As I said, there's a bit of a dispute between my various doctors as to whether I had a heart attack during my month in Washington. But whether or not I did have another heart attack there, I certainly regret the time and money I spent there. And, you know, thinking it over now, thinking back, turning back the clock, whatever it is, getting on for a decade and a half ago, I don't know whether I wouldn't be better, as I said, just to keep a list in your pocket of the countries that don't have extradition treaties with the United States. But the one Blair did with Bush is basically all about Blair being Bush's bitch. It's a grotesquely lopsided extradition treaty. And, you know, in fairness, I've no use for the present Australian government, but they told the mother country and the imperial metropolis to take a hike, and it was basically their decision to ignore the pressure from London, which was under pressure from Washington, and basically decide to look after the interests of their own citizen. That changed the way things went on that. But the settlement, you know, I understand that. He wants his life back. He's aged 40 years in the time this has been going on. And this should not have happened. It does not speak well for this appalling, appalling, appalling system. Edward says, when I heard that Assange was on a plane heading to see a judge on the remote Pacific island of Saipan, an unknown location to me, I thought it might be one of the remaining distant British parts of the crown that Mark sometimes mentions, where judges still have a wig, there is a feather-capped governor general. Yeah, ostrich feathers. You can't use, you know, like, chicken feathers. There's a feather-capped governor-general that lives in a Victorian rectory and has a 1960s Wolseley car to move around the island. But no, Saipan Island is US territory. Yes, and as I said, he was taking a gamble in being... You can't trust the Department of Justice. All kinds of people have trusted the Department of Justice and then got screwed over. We had Conrad Black talking about that on a recent Mark Stein show that you should listen to. Paul Nackman writes, "Hi Mark, greetings from Bozmanis." I think some words have run together in the version of your question I've got, Paul. Greetings from, maybe there is a Bozemanis. Greetings from Bozeman. Is your often expressed contempt for the US Constitution contempt for the document itself and the system it prescribes? Or is your beef actually with the degraded character of the US citizenry? After all, you've repeatedly stated that the Constitution is only relevant for people of virtue. That's approximately what John Adams said. That's not a point I make about the US Constitution. That's true of all constitutions, is they presume a virtuous people. Otherwise, you can do cynical constitutions like the Soviet Union's constitution, which sounds great, but constitutions at a certain level always presume the behavior of gentlemen. But Paul says, put another way, has anyone come up with something better than the US? Oh, my God. Oh, well, has anyone come up with something better than the US Constitution? Something that works robustly even with a non-virtuous public population? For example, the current messes made of the Westminster system in the UK and Canada suggest it's no panacea. The temporary success of governing arrangements seems to depend ultimately upon the quality of the people in high offices, the Washingtons and Madisons here, the Disraelis and Churchills in Britain, the Mustafa Kemals in Turkey, the Lee Kuan Yews in Singapore. No. There's a difference. Because if you, not the Turkish example, but the other ones you were talking about from the Commonwealth, you know, a constitution isn't a big thing in a Commonwealth country because as a matter of law, the king is the sovereign. The sovereign is the state, as, you know, a famous French king once said, l'état, c'est moi, the state is me, which as a point of law is correct. And you can say, oh, that's terrible, you know, that's awful. Why should we have to put up with that? Well, that's just the way it's been for most of human history. Now, the United States, when it threw off George III, decided it wasn't going to be a monarchy, so it had to come up with something else. And it seems to me pretty obvious. You swear in Canada, in the, you know, Canadian Parliament, or if you're a Canadian judge or a Canadian police officer or whatever, you swear allegiance to the king and his lawful heirs and successors. And so there's a vacuum in the American system, so you have to find something to plug the hole. And they came up with the Constitution to plug the hole. And because of that, oh, yes, we swear allegiance to the Constitution, you know. Whereas at a certain level, in the Canadian system, the king is the Constitution. If you look at the 1867 British North America Act, it doesn't mention things like prime ministers or elections or any of the rest of it because they're just evolving conventions. So I think the problem is that something that seemed like a clever practical maneuver using the Constitution to plug the hole where the monarch was then became a fetish. And you talk about it depending on the quality of people in high office. I don't think, you know, they were better than that, the US founders, because they came up with a system that took into account the fact that you were dealing with flawed human beings and tried to come up with a system that would that would be able to navigate around it. I don't like it. I don't like the idea of judges deciding things that I think are properly within the sphere of the people, or at any rate, their representatives. For example, I think it's much better, if you're into gay marriage, I think it's much better to do as the Irish and Australians did and hold a referendum, say, nah, we've just changed our mind. Or as David Cameron's god-awful Conservative Party did in the Palace of Westminster and do it legislatively. But I think torturing the language into your constitution to make it appear as though these guys in powdered wigs had cannily foreseen the need a couple of centuries hence to allow a man to marry another man, I think that's just bollocks. We know it's bollocks. And the problem is that if you're willing to torture the language to demonstrate that, then what can't you torture the language into doing, as we've just seen today, where the plain language of the First Amendment has been tortured by rock-ribbed conservatives like John Roberts, Amy Comey Barrett, and Kavanaugh. And inflict huge damage on the First Amendment. Now, this guy, Murphy, whatever he is, what is he? I've forgotten what he is. He's the public health surgeon general, is he? He's just moved on, having successfully blown a hole in the First Amendment. He's now moved on to the Second Amendment by citing gun ownership as a major public health crisis. Okay? That takes off. You want to bet on John Roberts and Amy Comey Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh standing against that? They've grown in office, haven't they? Who would have thought it? Especially for a big gang rapist like Brett Kavanaugh, a big underage beer-drinking gang rapist. He's, you know, grown in office. I don't know. Anyway, that's Paul's... Paul, but I don't say that about the US. All constitutions presume the behavior of gentlemen. The Westminster Constitution. Well, one of the other things is when you have a permanent state. Tony Blair made this worse, though, because he created an American style constitutional court, which, I just simply don't believe in that. I think that hands too much power to judges. And that's even before you consider what low quality judges there are today. I mean, basically, the people on the Supreme Court, I have a high regard for Alito and Thomas, but you can't honestly tell me there are genius jurists sitting on that court. As I always say, the fellow who was in the, when, cockwombling Carrie Katz and CRTV with the help of that rock-ribbed constitutionalist Mark Levin, when they sued me for the second time, the judge we had in that case was absolutely fantastic. Now, he wasn't a conservative. He wasn't a liberal. I don't know his politics, but I think I can deduce that they're nothing like mine. But his legal reasoning puts this awful, awful First Amendment. And his defense of the First Amendment, by the way, in his decision at the end of that case, where he goes through 100 specific claims by cockwombling Carrie Katz and Mark Levin and rejects them all. And then he has this rather spirited defense of the First Amendment at the end of it, which is not something you get in today's decision. Today's decision means that basically gives the green light to the government of the United States, which is not allowed to abridge free speech. Oh, yeah, you can't abridge free speech, but you're allowed to team up with a corrupt social media cartel behind the scenes and get them to abridge it for you. Disgraceful, disgraceful. We have this question from Chris Davis. Chris threw this wonderful party for me after the hearing in the High Court in London, in the Strand. We all repaired to Chris's club, and he threw this wonderful party for me and Naomi and Norman Fenton and Claire Craig. And all kinds of, and some of our dear vaccine victims like Wayne Cunnington and Howard Griffiths, and just a lovely Jules Serkin, just a lovely, lovely event. Chris writes, Mark, have you ever come across a situation where someone is arrested and released on bail without charge, but unable to leave Calgary or even return to the United Kingdom. The Trudeaus really have turned English-speaking Canada into a police state. And this is in reference to Tommy Robinson, who gave a tremendous speech. He was doing a three-stop Canadian tour with Ezra Levant and Rebel News, who'd organized it, booked the venues, sold tickets, and all the rest of it. They admitted him into the country, His Majesty's immigration officials, and then mysteriously decided during his first speech, they sent along undercover coppers wearing plaid shirts and the like. And at the end of his event, first event in Calgary, the undercover coppers, plus some uniformed guys who'd shown up from the Calgary police, then arrested him. And as Chris notes, have imposed very specific bail requirements. He basically has to stay where he is, which is a bit of a problem when you're supposed to be doing a national tour. They took his passport. If it's an immigration infringement, normally what happens is that you're taken straight to the airport and put on a plane back to wherever it is you came from, and because they made an error in admitting you to the country in the first place. Now, there are specific bail conditions. In this case, if they're keeping him there in order to bring him to trial in Canada, which I think would be odd, then, you know, in theory, instead of putting Ezra Levant out of pocket and Rebel News and all these people who've paid for the meet and greet with Tommy Robinson and everything, you'd think, well, we're keeping him in the country. We might as well let him do the tour. No. And what's interesting is when Tommy's got a video up there about it, when he goes along to see Canadian immigration, whatever they're called now, They basically up front that they, you know, they can't really answer the questions because this is all being done at a way higher level, way higher than anybody in Alberta, you know. So in other words, it's being done at Justin level, or maybe Justin and Rishi level. Maybe there's a bit of Anglo-Canadian coordination going on this. You got to get used to this. My friend Raisa Blumenstein, who's also Ava Vladingerbrook's friend, and some of you will know her from the Mark Stein Adriatic cruise, and she's a wonderful lady, and she's in trouble for hate speech or whatever. She's going to be on trial in the Netherlands in, I think it's next month, and I'm going to go there. It's because I know from personal experience how bloody lonely these things can be. And I know after my appearance in London, it was just so heartening to just have people supporting you everywhere you look. When I arrived at the Strand that morning, it just meant so much to me. So I'm going to do the same for Racer, because she's in that situation that a lot of people are familiar with now, where mysteriously all the big shots in your Rolodex are no longer, she wouldn't know what that is. I think the Rolodex was obsolete like two decades before she was born. But anyway, Racer, I'm going to do that because I don't want Racer to have that feeling. But what's going to happen? This is the problem. This is the problem here. It's going to be very difficult to go anywhere, to move. Freedom of movement is being shrunk for everybody. But it's being for people who are basically the target of political prosecutions, as Tommy Robinson and Raisa Blumenstein are basically going to find it harder and harder to move around anywhere. And I look back, it seems like just the day before yesterday that I won my tremendous victory over the Canadian human rights regime. They're coming back. And they're building, it doesn't matter whether you're in Canada, as Tommy Robinson has just discovered. You know, it's one thing, you've seen how the London coppers, the Scotland Yard blokes, just jump on him and make an example of him. Oh, and what a surprise. Now His Majesty's Constabulary in Calgary is doing exactly the same thing. This is the world they're building for those who dissent from the narrative. And it's going to get worse. And that's why, you know, putting your faith in judges, the Mark Levin constitution-waving way, you know, as we've just seen, that's not going to do it. Because basically, America in particular is a post-constitutional republic. And the judges are now formulating their decisions to align with the new order. So put down that bloody constitution. You look like a parochial idiot waving it. As always say, the Republic of Venice lasted 1,000 years. That's four times as long as your republic has lasted, and most Americans haven't even heard of it. You know, oh, it's a fantastic constitution, this. No. No, we just, for the last century, allowing language, the plain meaning of the, we have a thing in New Hampshire that statutes have to be construed according to the plain meaning of the language. And the plain meaning of the language of the First Amendment is that the government is not allowed to abridge freedom of speech. Nothing to do with whether it's allowed to find some non-coercive way to abridge freedom of speech. This is rubbish, and all the time and effort you invested in Amy Comey Barrett and what's their beer boy was a complete waste of time. Let's pause a moment from the passing Charivari. We were supposed to be into our new long-running summer tale for our time right now, but I've been besieged by vocal problems brought on by my trip to the aforementioned High Court in London. And then, as you could hear last week, I was pretty grief-stricken by poor Marvin's death and could hardly talk. So our new tale has been put back a few days. But I thank you for your appreciation, very fulsome, of our Hans Christian Andersen short story, The Shadow, which listeners seem to enjoy. So in lieu of our full-length tale, I thought we'd have another Hans Christian Andersen. Here are me and my sweet gingerbread gal, Jessica Martin, with our version of Hans Christian Andersen's most famous story, and one that has become an almost universal allegory. This was a fun studio session. I remember we made the decision shortly, I think just that morning over coffee, as everybody was setting up, we made the decision not to just sing the song, but to, in effect, dramatize it, which involved roping in all kinds of persons who happened just to be within press-ganging distance that morning, such as an actor. I won't embarrass him by mentioning his name, but I hadn't seen him since the West End production of Budgie the Musical in London in 1988, and he just happened to be doing something in the adjoining room. And our dramatic interpretation was a bit improvised too. I remember mentioning that I'd just been given an award in New York, and as I was standing on stage having my photograph taken with the trophy, Sarah, Duchess of York, Fergie, gatecrashed the event, leapt up next to me and inserted herself into the pictures. Very odd, but I think she had some deal with a press agent or something, that she got $50 or whatever for showing up and elbowing herself into the photographs. Anyway, after hearing about this, Jessica decided just... I didn't know until she started singing, but she decided to revive for the voice of the Duchess here the old Fergie voice she used to use on Spitting Image on British telly. So herewith, me as the King, Jessica as most everyone else, in the tale of The King's New Clothes.
Once upon a time, there was a king. Now, this king was very fond of fashion, and one day two swindlers came to sell him what they said was a magic suit of clothes. Now, To tell the truth, there wasn't any suit of clothes, but the swindlers held up their hands like this. And they said, "Your Majesty, this is a magic suit of clothes." And His Majesty said,
"Well, where is it?"
And the swindlers said, "Here it is, Your Majesty. Naturally, since you're so wise and intelligent, you can see how beautiful it is. But to a fool, it is absolutely invisible."
Oh, I see,
said the king.
I see.
And not wanting to appear a fool, he quickly added,
"Isn't it grand? Isn't it fine? Look at the cut, the style, the line. The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes that I have ever seen. These eyes of mine at once determine, the sleeves are velvet, the cape is ermine, the hose are blue, and the doublet is a lovely shade of green.
Lovely shade of green.
Somebody send for the queen."
Well, the queen arrived and was told how only wise people could see the magic suit of clothes. And not wanting to appear a fool, she quickly agreed,
"Isn't it isn't it isn't it absolutely The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes that I have ever seen. These eyes of mine at once determine, the sleeves are velvet, the cape is ermine, the hose are blue, and the doublet is a lovely shade of green.
Lovely shade of green.
Summon the court to convene."
The royal court convened, and the ministers came in. And the ambassadors, and the counts, and the dukes and duchesses. And they all gathered round and were told about the magic suit of clothes. And not wanting to seem like fools, they also agreed,
"Isn't it great?
Isn't it rich?
Look at the charm of every stitch. The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether is altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes, as you've already said. These eyes of ours at once determine,
the sleeves are velvet, the cape is ermine,
the hose are blue, and the doublet is a lovely shade of red.
Green! Oh yes, green!
How could we think it was red?"
And the king issued a proclamation as follows.
The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes a tailor ever made. Now quickly put it all together with gloves of leather and hat and feather. It's altogether the thing to wear in Saturday's parade.
Saturday's parade.
Leading the royal brigade.
And Saturday came. And by that time, the whole kingdom had heard about the magic suit of clothes, and everyone was very anxious to see His Majesty marching in his splendid new raiment. The streets were lined with thousands and thousands of the king's subjects as the artillery marched by, and the cavalry marched by, and the fife and drum corps, and the naval cadets marched by, and the Foreign Legion, and the Royal Guard. And finally, the King.
The King!
And everybody shouted and cheered, for nobody wanted to appear a fool. Nobody, that is, except one little boy, who for some reason hadn't heard about the magic suit of clothes and didn't know what he was supposed to see. He took one look at His Majesty and exclaimed,
"Look at the king! Look at the king! Look at the king! The king! The king! The king is in the altogether, but altogether, the altogether, he's altogether as naked as the day that he was born.
The king is in the altogether, but altogether, the altogether,
he's altogether the very least the king has ever worn.
Call the court physician!
Call an intermission!
His Majesty is wide open to ridicule and scorn.
The king is in the altogether, but altogether, the altogether, he's altogether as naked as the day that he was born.
And it's altogether too chilly a morn." Words and music by Frank Lesser. Yours truly with Miss Jessica Martin. And a cast of thousands with orchestra arranged and conducted by Kevin Amos. Such a fun arrangement. You know, when
Jessica describes the different military elements marching in the Royal Parade. We gave each of them a different Frank Lesser song to play. Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition, Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. You probably recognise a few of them. The one that always makes me laugh is the one we chose for the Foreign Legion, a rather louche rendering of Sand in My Shoes. And then at the end, after I sing And It's Altogether Too Chilly a Morn, there's a blast of the title phrase of Baby, It's Cold Outside. A musical tale for our time. A non-musical tale begins next week at Stein Online. We are live around the planet. It is 11 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 11 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Johnny Woodrow writes, Dear Mark, Abby Roberts and I have been talking on our podcasts. I'm not plugging. Podcasts are where we tend to hang out for chats. We have been talking about truth, goodness, and beauty as three universal principles that have been under attack, that need recovering to rebuild society and also give us a basis for optimism. We are trying to find positive ways forward in the insanity of the decaying West. Tyranny shows its hand by attempting to subvert these three universals, but they reassert themselves even under oppression. Personally, I think this is because truth, goodness, and beauty are attributes of God communicated through the created order. That is why I think your show on Serenade Radio is as important as your satirical commentary on current affairs. It explores and celebrates cultural goods. What do you think? Are you optimistic for the resurgence of truth, goodness, and beauty in the long term? Is that what keeps you going with music and commentary? Condolences on the loss of Marvin, an expression of the goodness and beauty of the Creator. Blessings, says Johnny. Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's true. You know, if you saw our piece this morning and that tweet, including a naked drag queen with hideous fake knockers fully on display, it's amazing the things that can, when you talk about beauty, the ability, it really speaks very oddly for a society when it is so unbeautiful that it has an ability even to wreck breasts. But that was certainly the case of this hideous pneumatic drag queen dragging a three-year-old girl around on stage, naked, semi-naked drag queen, dragging this three-year-old girl while all the parents and the friends all look on, cooing, ooing, and eyeing. Ours is an ugly world. And the fact of the matter is, when you talk about something like truth, there is beauty is truth and truth beauty, as Keats said. And that is true. And so if you have a society without beauty, it's not surprising that it winds up without truth. And if you just think of the, well, for example, when was the last time you read a poem as good as Keats? There's people who don't like Keats, but here's the question. What living poet, the wankers that they, the diversity wankers they put up to read crap at these presidential inaugurations, when was the last time? So poetry is one of the skills that our age has lost. Symphonies is one of the skills. We're going to, I think, is it this week or sometime in the next few days on the Serenade Show, I'm going to be playing one of the last beautiful concerti. So we've lost the knack of being able to do that. We've lost the knack of being able to do painting, statues. So there is not a lot of beauty. And so seeing people destroying everything, seeing whatever they call Just Stop Oil attempting to destroy paintings, And then Antifa toppling statues. It's interesting that we're an age that can no longer make beauty, and it is necessary thus to destroy the beauty that our predecessors made. But this is all, you know, people think, the hyper-rationalists always, oh, we don't need religion. And we don't need beauty, you know. It's all this symphony stuff, this poetry stuff. It's all Squaresville. We don't need that because hyper-rationally we understand that people can be good without any transcendent meaning to life or without any beauty in life now. All the greatest works of art, greatest paintings, the greatest buildings, the greatest pieces of music were all done in honor of the creator. So it's not a surprise that when that all goes, you've got a twerking drag queen dragging a three-year-old kid around. And again, as I said, when I posted that tweet, the mullahs can't nuke us soon enough. But the reality is that Islam is not a beautiful society because it has no ability to create that kind of beauty. And so we have to be serious about this. I understand for tactical reasons people get excited because Kanye appears to be pro-Trump for 20 minutes before, you know, his brain switches and he moves on to something else. I understand how people get excited. Oh, look, a hip celebrity has taken kind of an interest in my kind of politics. But, you know, that isn't going to... There's no future in that either. That's not going to do it for you. Thank you for that question, Johnny. An interested question. Peter says, greetings, Mark. In your estimation, just how far over the cliff is Western civilization? 20%, 80%? Is it Russia 1905 or 1917? Well, I would say, percentage-wise, I would say we're getting close to 80%. Year-wise, I would say we're about halfway between 1905 and 1917. So I don't want to, you know... I'm not exaggerating, really, at the rate at which we are going over the cliff. It's actually, what is 1905? That's 12 years. So, yeah, 6 years. 6 years from our 1917. That wouldn't surprise me. April says, why would a president need a week of preparation for questions on issues in which he should be completely immersed and he is allegedly actively addressing? Oops, I may have just answered my own question. This is in reference to tomorrow's Trump-Biden debate. And the answer, April, is that if it all goes well, it isn't going to be about anything he's completely immersed in, whatever that is. I don't think he's completely immersed in anything. He's like spending every weekend in Delaware or at his beach house, whichever state that's in. A lot of property for a man who's been in public service for for half a century. He has acquired an impressive property portfolio, which one would not have thought possible on the salary he has been earning this last half century. But anyway, Joe Biden, it's nothing to do with any current issues, whatever you think the current issues are, the open border or the Ukraine war or whatever you happen to think it is. It's nothing to do with anything. Because the object here is to make it about Trump. So he has to be trained to... He's not going to talk about any of the last 3.5 years or whatever it is. He's got to learn... He's got to be trained to turn everything onto Trump and trump up the whole thing. So that the impression is that Trump is the reason why everything's bad and Trump is the danger and we can't have Trump in. So it's nothing to do with that. I mean, this whole thing is, they're not even training him. What they're doing, I mean, they're giving him, they'll be practicing him with things they're written into the prompter and they'll be doing their best to get it right so he doesn't read out the stage directions, you know, pause and look serious. So they're going to be doing that. But what they're mainly doing is testing the medication so they can determine the point at which to give him the shot that will get him through the couple of hours. Joe McInerney says on this theme, so Mark, remember tonight, after building a set identical to the CNN debate stage, audience seating, no audience, of course, they might cheer the wrong guy, lighting in place, podiums with proper marking, and arrows showing exact directions, and golf carts are ready. Here come 16 of the best and brightest from the halls of academia and politics to coach the man of the hour, Joe Biden. So 10 days of memorization, insults at the ready, January 6th gaslighting, politically built indictments for slinging, and most importantly, which drugs will be effective during the 3 times daily standing practice sessions for the commander in sleep as he takes on the most dangerous of dangers, the Orange Man. The trap is set, the actors in place, the gag order ready, and then drum roll, Jake Tapper of CNN will debate Trump. Yeah, this is where you have to wonder, you know, everyone, because people, the people say, oh, Trump, he plays all this fourth dimensional chess or whatever. He agreed to a debate. Joe Biden had his sagging numbers and challenged Trump to a debate. And then, you know, said, I hear you're free on Wednesdays, taunting him and all. And it's one thing to say, yeah, OK, anytime you want. He shouldn't have agreed to these two. He shouldn't have agreed to CNN. And he shouldn't have agreed in particular to these two moderators, Jake Tapper and whoever the other one is. All three of them are on the record. Biden, Jake Tapper and whoever the third one is are all on the record as having compared Trump to... Oh, by the way... because it's not just the names of CNN moderators, I forget. I should correct something I said earlier. I think I said it was, did I say the two states in this Supreme Court case were Louisiana and Mississippi? In fact, it's Louisiana and Missouri. I'm a foreigner. I got a good excuse. All your American states seem the same to me. I can't really tell the difference between, you know, Vermont and Texas. They all seem pretty American to me. And so I got whatever it is, Mississippi and Missouri, apparently mixed up. It's Louisiana and Missouri. So, Mr. Foreign, I used to be much better at this when I guest hosted for Rush. I used to generally be on top of states. Mr. Snerdley would always, if we had callers lined up, he would always say so-and-so and then name a town. And I would have no, I'd be thinking, what town is that? What state is it in? But anyway, I was still better. I knew not to say tomato and say tomato. I used to be good at all that, you say tomato, you say tomato stuff. It's all fallen apart since my heart attacks. And so evidently is the ability to distinguish between Mississippi and Missouri. But it's this case was about Louisiana and Missouri. But yeah, I think Joe has a point here that I don't, that it's one thing to agree to a debate, then to agree to a debate with two moderators who have said you're Hitler. You know, Ann Coulter has a piece today. Now, obviously, Ann Coulter has her differences with Trump, and they go back a ways. But she says that she's written a column. I haven't read it. I just happened to see the headline somewhere or other, why Trump will lose the debate. You know, he's going to have to be super disciplined about this in turning it on to Biden. No, you're the president. And the last 3.5 years, America has been governed by you and your appointees. And he's going to have to keep it on him. And the question is, I think he could do that if he had a fair moderator. But if you have basically, and I'm not even talking about the Candy Crowley thing that she famously piled on when Mitt had Obama on the ropes and Candy Crowley also from CNN. I mean, why do... I just don't, I don't get it. I don't get why you agree to play the game every time on the enemy's terms. Because it's, you know, a debate has to be fair. The moderator has to be fair. And what this will mean is that any issue, you know, such as immigration, and this is where Trump has to be careful, because he was doing this on a call the other day, in which he basically said that anyone who completes a degree in the United States, a foreigner who completes a degree, should be given a green card. He said this just because he was with these, you know, corporate titans. That's the way they think about things. That's not the way his voters think about things. But it tells you the danger in what's going to happen tomorrow night is that Jake Tapper and the other one, who I can't remember, Mississippi, are going to frame everything. Even Republican issues are going to be framed in Democrat terms. So if immigration comes up, oh, it'll be about the need for, what is your plan for comprehensive immigration reform? That's not what it's about. It's the fact that Biden has opened the borders to let in millions and millions of people who virtually every day of the week now are raping and murdering US citizens. I made a point on Tucker, I got hammered for it, that I said every country, every society produces sufficient of its own murderers and rapists. There's no need to let any other people in. And people have a right to be aggrieved when they're mourning a child who has been raped and murdered by someone who shouldn't even have been in the country. But that's not how immigration is going to be brought up by Jake Tapper. It's all going to be, what's your plan for comprehensive immigration reform? So I think there's great peril for Trump in lies tomorrow night. And I hope, you know, I hope that this 10 days of preparation for Biden, you know, he's not serving as head of the executive branch, so he's not doing anything anyway. So he's got 10 days to take off and be prepped for it. And they'll be serious. I think it will be like that, you know, everyone will be, oh, they told us he was brain dead. They told us he can't even get into a motor car. They told us he just keeps wandering off at the G7 and random prime ministers have to run after him and drag him back because his eye's been caught by a fetching six-year-old girl on the horizon and he's gone off to sniff her hair. And he's supposed to be standing there for the communique. They can say, that's all rubbish. This is like the State of the Union. You know, they're just trying to get the precise degree of the cocktail right. Robert Norris says, Mark, I see that the PBS program Theatre Talk ended its run in 2018. I think everyone should watch the YouTube video of your appearance on that show, since it was so funny and entertaining. Do you keep up with the purveyors of that program, or did they disown you until the degradation of the theatre made their program unviable? No, Michael Riedel, who was the host of that show, I don't know which. I was on that, I think, a few times. I don't know which particular appearance you're talking about, but I always enjoyed doing that show. Michael Riedel was the theatre was the Broadway gossip columnist for the New York Post, and I think he now does the morning show, does rather well on WOR, which used to be the station in New York. It used to be the station that for best part of a century carried Rambling with Gambling. I think it was three generations of the gambling family. And then eventually they decided to hang it up. And Michael Riedel does that show now. And he's an excellent fellow. And I think I was asked on that show. I'm not in great shape, and so I'm not saying yes to a lot of invitations like that, because it's hit and miss whether, you know, I'd have to take 10 days off and they'd have to try and get the strength of the cocktail right and everything. But Michael Riedel is certainly an admirable fellow and a very special talent, not just on subjects theatrical, but more generally as well. Claudia writes, Dear Mark, in times of trouble, a la Paul Simon, do you have specific favourite hymns that comfort you? aside from your Lessons and Carols special, have you ever done a show about sacred hymns? You have our deepest sympathy on the loss of Marvin. I like the hymns of my childhood. So I have a particular fondness for a certain kind of Anglican hymn, such as Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, or Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer. I do love those. You know, the Lessons and Carols, I just had an email from the other day from Rhoda Barfoot, who did a wonderful version of O Come, O Come, Emmanuel on our Christmas Eve show. And that's, to put that together is, you'd put it together well. Requires quite a bit of thought, and I'm not sure, unless I was to convert Stein Online into an actual church and do a service every Sunday, I'm not sure we could do that more often than we do. But I do have a particular fondness for those, as I said, those Anglican hymns that I sang so often as a child. I think, Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer, and even things like All Things Bright and Beautiful. You know, we were talking about beauty. I think that's I think for children to sing, you know, I think when I was the kid, that the age of that kid, being dragged around by the drag queen with the hideous concrete knockers sitting on the chest like two bombes surprise, just stuck in place. I was thinking, you know, when I was that kid's age, I was singing All Things Bright and Beautiful. And I think that's better. I think that's a small example. You know, you say, okay, we're taking out All Things Bright and Beautiful, and instead, for music, you're going to twerk on stage with a naked drag queen. Yeah, come on, Mullers. You talk a good game, but when are you actually going to get around to nuking us? Suzanne Rennie says, have you heard about Montreal's latest Pally encampment in Victoria Square? I used to drive through Victoria Square very, very frequently. I can't remember the last time I did. But attempts to remove Queen Victoria's statue were unsuccessful. Not due to the police, mind you. The wankers just stood around and watched, like they did when Sir John A. Macdonald's statue in Place du Canada came down a few years ago. Will these encamped demonstrators be removed from McGill and Victoria Square, or is this the new normal? It's the new normal. It's going to be across the Western world. It's going to be, across the English-speaking world, because the French are made of sterner stuff. They need to destroy the past. It's exactly the same as with the Taliban and the Buddhas, or ISIS and Palmyra in Syria. They have to destroy the entire past so there's nothing to go back to. And again, it's about the loss of beauty. It's, you look at these statues, you know, and some of these statues were put up by public subscription, and some of them quite important if you're putting up a statue of the sovereign, as you are in Victoria Square. But if you just look at you wander past statues of blokes you've never heard of, and when you try to figure out what they were, they weren't that big a deal. But people were able to make a magnificent statue in those days, in a way that we can't now. Now, everything is going to go. Everything is going to go. Because the idea is that your society then has no foundations. They're not just destroying the statue. They're basically destroying the plinth so that you have nothing to stand on. The ground is always soft and uncertain and could give way at any moment. There is no foundation to our society. That's the object. Norman Fenton says, it was great to see Norman in London when I was there. Norman says, so on the same day Tommy Robinson got arrested, yet again on trumped-up charges. Yeah, and it's interesting now, the trumped-up charges can be spread from country to country. Julian Assange was finally released. Have you noticed that whereas free speech advocates from both left and right supported Assange's bid for freedom, none from the left ever expressed any concern at Tommy's never-ending wrongful arrests and imprisonments for nothing other than doing reporting. In fact, the lefties who campaigned for and celebrated Assange's release are the same people who rejoice whenever Tommy is wrongfully arrested. Carol Vorderman, for example, posted, "Tommy Robinson arrested as an illegal immigrant in Canada. It's Rwanda for you, my boy." Yeah, that isn't even true. He was admitted to the country. They admitted him as they would admit, you know, Gladys Scroggins if she decided to go for a vacation in Winnipeg. So Carol Vorderman isn't even correct there. He's not an illegal immigrant. They screwed up. If they wanted to turn him back, well, no, they didn't screw up. They set him up. But I would slightly disagree with Norman there. One of the things I learned through the... We've done specials. We covered the Assange. I covered the Assange case when I was hosting on Fox. And I then covered the Assange case when I was hosting on GB News. And we did a special. There's a big special with Julian Assange's brother and his father and various other bits and pieces. We cover that story. And one of the things that was always true for me is that the left wasn't really there for him. They would do a bit of pro forma tut-tutting about it. But in the end, you know, as I would say, I was far more... Well, my problem with the Julian Assange case is that the system is corrupt. So if he had been delivered into the hands of the American, if he had put on a flight to Washington, you would never have seen him again. He would have died in a supermax. It's an evil system. And this is another reason why I don't like the Constitution waving, because the implication that you've got a land of laws when you have the Department of the Bureau of Prisons, people who mysteriously were looking the other way when Jeffrey Epstein died. You know, the cameras, unfortunately, the cameras were off and the two guards were asleep. But don't worry, it's all on the up and up. The Bureau of Prisons is run by the Department of Justice. You know, in some systems, I don't know, in some systems, they're separate. You know, you'll have a justice ministry running the legal system, and you'll have the interior ministry running the prison system or whatever. But in the Department of Justice, they're the same, which becomes all very convenient when there's someone you don't actually want going to trial in open court, whether that's Jeffrey Epstein or Julian Assange. So that's my main objection to it, always was. But I didn't detect a lot of serious, full-throated left-wing support for Assange. Now, you're quite right about Tommy Robinson. And Veronica, in our comments section in Auckland, is always going on, it's just the friend-enemy distinction. And guys like me are Mr. Squaresville, because we think it should be all about first principles. You know, so I don't like the coppers jumping Tommy Robinson when he hasn't done anything in a London street or at a Calgary event venue. I don't like it. It's nothing to do with Tommy Robinson or Julian Assange. It's simply that this is increasing, and it's nothing to do with the friend-enemy distinction, because what it is it's increasingly people who are inconvenient to the state have to be ruined. And there's not a lot of objection to it. You know, you get these wankers, whether it's Matthew Sweet, who are actually quite happy to be shills for a big, overbearing state. And then you have, as we saw at the US Supreme Court today, judges who are happy to incentivize the actions of a big, overbearing state. I don't go for that. Thank you for that question, Norman. We've got a lot of great questions that I didn't get to, which I regret. But that is just the way. Do read them. They're very interesting questions. And once in a while, although it has been a while, I do like to have a sort of follow-up session on all those things. You want music? Ah, tough. As you know, in order that we can expand our coverage of the things that really matter in the world, like Mitch McConnell and Chris Christie and Nikki Whatnot Haley, we've moved all the music to Saturdays on Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time. That's 6 p.m. in Western Europe, 12 noon North American Eastern. And I hope you'll want to join me this weekend for that. It's a lovely show, I think, we got planned for this weekend. But that's going to do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in, the water's fine. And don't forget, for the Steinshy chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.